Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thank you all. Back to the Talmud. Kaf Gimel Amud Aleph, 23a. We are beginning a slightly different subject on 23a. It's the first real paragraph that begins on the English side of the page. 23a1. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught. Tanu Rabbanan is a classic introduction to a baraita. Okay, we now have a baraita. Avel Shabbat Rishona Eino Yotzei Mipetach Beito. A mourner. Now here the Hebrew is hard to translate because it could mean really two different things. Shabbat Rishona could mean the first Shabbat, or Shabbat Rishona could be the first week, because in Hebrew, in classic rabbinic Hebrew, Shabbat also means a week. Okay? So it could be either one. Right? Avel Shabbat Rishona Eino Yotzei Mipetach Beito. If it means a week, then that would follow with what we would logically think, because an avel during the first week should not leave the house.
Except Shabbat, if he goes to shul.
Correct. Correct. So that's why, well, realize you're reflecting on what you know is the halacha. You know what our practice is. Part of that practice comes from the difficulty of understanding what this is saying. Because it could be the week. And therefore, but however, the Shabbat is different because there is no mourning on Shabbat. Or it could be that the purpose of this is to come to say, Avel Shabbat Rishona, on the first Shabbat that you are a mourner, even though you might have thought that you're supposed to go out of the house, you shouldn't go out of the house. It could mean that.
Yes.
Just from the text itself, we really don't know how to interpret it. And this, you'll see later on, probably not tonight, but next time, is developed in the Gemara, because it's really a question: to what extent is there mourning on the Sabbath? That's really behind the reading here and the difficulty in knowing how to read this. Because it could be that on the Sabbath, in effect, there is little or no mourning. Or it could be that there is mourning on the Sabbath. We don't really know for sure at this stage of the game. Okay? So it's hard to know. It's hard to know. It could go either way. We know from our practice that, in fact, what is the custom is that an avel, a mourner, during the first week is not supposed to leave the house. Right? So that if you are a mourner, that's one of the reasons we bring the services into the house. Because the mourner is not supposed to leave the house. And of course, if the mourner doesn't have the services, it's okay to go out of the house and to come to the synagogue for the services and then to go back in the house. But the ideal situation is for the mourner, in fact, would be all the time in the house. All the time, and not leave the house during the Shiva period. Okay? So that would be the force then of the beginning of the Baraita. Shni'ah. Let's see whether number 8 has some comment here.
There's no observing from one another. That's basically what I said.
Okay. Shni'ah. The second week. Maybe, if Shabbat means week. Shnia yotzei ve'eno yoshed bimkomo. The second week he may go out of his house, but he does not sit in his regular place in the synagogue. Now that is the custom. Custom is that if you have a regular place, you don't occupy that place in the period after Shiva. And some will do that for Shloshim, some will do that for a week, some will do it for 2 weeks, variety of customs there, and you'll see some of it is going to be articulated here. So, Shnia yotzei ve'eno yoshev bimkomo. Shlishit yoshev bimkomo ve'eno medaber. It's a very funny kind of statement. The third week, you're allowed to go out and go to the synagogue, Yoshev Bimkomo, and you can sit in your place, Ve'eino Medaber, but you can't talk.
That's the way everybody should be.
I mean, you can't
snooze,
or
you're not.
You're not.
We I like to think it means that you should be sullen.
Right.
You know, that the type of behavior that you shouldn't be interacting with people like you normally interact with people. Okay? And that you should withdraw yourself. Because you're showing during the time that you move your seat, you're presenting to everybody's aware of the fact that you moved your seat. Because people generally are aware of where they sit and where other people sit in the synagogue. I mean, I'll sometimes see that. I know people where they sit and they change their place. I say, what happened? I mean, it's, you know, people just don't change their places. So, are you feeling all right? You know, what's going on? That a person changes. Because people are pretty consistent about where they sit in the synagogue. That's very common. So the effect of actually changing your place is to create a little bit of discontent or disorder in the public viewing of you, which is what's the public. That's appropriate. Then you finally go back to your place, and if everything were returned to normal, that also wouldn't seem too appropriate. So you sort of go in stages. First, you're not there. Then you're there, but you're in the wrong place. Then you're there in the right place, but you don't interact with the people normally. Okay? I think that's really what it is. I said there's a funny side to it, because it makes you wonder. I mean, you could read this in one way to say that, you know, normally all the time you do talk.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a lot of shuls, they just don't do anything but talk. At least the men. I can't tell you about the women, but particularly in shuls where there's separation.
That's
one of the reasons that I've always felt that there's something serious, something very good to be said about mixed seating.
Right.
Cut down on the talking.
That's right.
I mean, I know our congregants, I don't have this experience because I don't get around. I'm sort of always in the same place. But some of our congregants who do get around and go to some of the other alternatives in the neighborhood, say the Orthodox shuls, they just talk all the time. They talk. And there isn't a level of seriousness and of concentration that there is in a place like Rosh Arua. So that's a good sign. I mean, that's a possibly good sign. Having said that, I don't want you to think that that's the only way it can be. One of the nice things about being in the Israeli synagogues is that they take the thing seriously. They take it seriously. The Israeli Orthodox synagogues, there's absolutely no talking. At least the ones that I frequent, there's no talking at all.
They don't speak Hebrew, that's why.
When I was in Italy, I went to an Orthodox synagogue, and there was I was stunned. The women upstairs behaved like the women do in the Orthodox shuls. They didn't stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
It was non-stop.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it. It was an Italian. But it was non-stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very common. I mean, it's not unusual. And lest you think it's only the women, it's not. There's a tremendous amount of talking that goes on. And I just reflect on this little piece of Gemara here. I don't think it's to be bent in that way. You know, that you don't participate in a normal jabbering that goes on during the synagogue service. I really don't think it's to be taken that way. But you could read it that way. Revi'it, the fourth week, Harehu Kechol Adam. Right. By the fourth week, everything is back to normal. Everything is back to normal in terms of the way you function in the synagogue. Okay. Hare is literally behold, but it's used for. It really can't trust that. It's a word that's frequently brought for emphasis. Like now. In English. What?
Is
as everybody else. Okay, that's good. That's a good translation. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Lo hutzrechu lomar Shabbat Rishana lo yotze mi petach beito. Sharei akol nichnasim leveito lenachamo. There's no reason to say that the first week you have to stay home. We already know that. Because the first week is called Shiva. And during Shiva, of course you stay home. So what does the Braita have to come and tell us that during the first week you stay home? That's not necessary. Maybe that's obvious.
Logical.
It's logical. Okay? Ella shnia eino yotze mipetach beito. But what Rabbi Yehuda does is that he kicks everything up 1 week. When it says the first week, it means the first week after Shiva. Because the Braita doesn't have to come and tell us the first week. We already know the first week. So when if a Braita comes and says the first week, it must mean the second week. Very logical. First week is the second week. The second week, of course, means the third week. The third week means the fourth week. The fourth week means the fifth week.
I think he's right.
Okay?
Yes,
you think he's right?
I think he's right because it's the fourth week.
Well, let's see.
The fifth week is after the Shloshim.
Right. But if it weren't, in the fourth week, he'd still be in Shloshim, and he's really not yet right with everybody.
It's possible. Unless that's not a part of Shloshim. Not exact.
Well, just saying if we're...
You're out of the Shloshim. You're into the next phase. Right?
Right. Certainly by the fifth.
Yep. Okay.
Could you compare this? We had a section there discussing how people interact. When is it appropriate to greet someone who wasn't available? Do you have to wait till after the shalosh? Does he greet you? I don't remember the specifics.
Right.
But even after one rejoins the community, you don't treat him in terms of who initiates conversation, what the subject is. When is it appropriate?
Mm-hmm. That's similar. It is similar.
So
it seems to be
similar.
Yeah. Remember, if you remember the last time the subject of the synagogue came up, it was in connection to the death of the Av Beit Din and of the Nasi. For the first time, the synagogue came up in the conversation in the Gemara last time. And that's probably from the editor's perspective why we're now talking about the synagogue again. We got into the synagogue, and so we continue, as it were, the synagogue, just giving other things. I think that the same idea is there, that the idea of interaction with people is not normal. One tries to create an abnormal situation to reflect the inner abnormal situation. Okay? So far, so good? Good, let's go.
Does it mean a devotee during the first week, people really just stay in their house?
Yep.
But, I mean, you're supposed to go to the house of the person that died, like your parents' house. And you would stay in your parents' house and then return to your own house?
Well, ideally, ideally, if one is able to observe the Shiva in the house of the deceased, then this would mean that one stays in the house of the deceased for that entire period of time. So that's what it would and does mean. Practical purposes, practical reasons, it often doesn't work out exactly like that. It's too small, it's too complicated to work out, so practically you will find that different things actually occur, but in an ideal situation, that's the ideal situation.
What happens when you can't get a minion at the house of the deceased?
Then the mourner, assuming the mourner wants to go to the synagogue, the mourner does go to the synagogue. Okay? So that's one of the reasons why there is such a an emphasis on providing the minyan for the mourner in the house of mourning to alleviate that anxiety and to make it possible for the mourner to stay home during that entire period of time, with the exception now of the Sabbath. In fact, the law is that on the Sabbath one does go out, although I know there are some, some who don't do that, but by and large the custom is on the Sabbath one does go out. Yes.
As far as the question of this gentleman, what mostly occurs is that if you have parents, usually one passes away, so the home still has one parent left, and therefore you go to the home of the parent, which is not empty.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
true.
Usual, or the cases are rarer, that both of them happen to pass away at the same time,
right.
Or that one already has passed and the second one passes.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because if you're reflecting on the fact that when the second one passes, in fact, none of the residents of the house, none of the normal residents, are still living, it seems odd, because you are in the house of people who themselves are not there, and it's an odd kind of a circumstance, but that is, in fact, the custom, to the extent that it is a doable job. But, I mean, again, I don't want to leave it before hastening to add that remember the two other rules that you have to apply to this, and that is Sechel and Derech Eretz. Remember, those are your six pillars of the Shulchan Aruch here. Particularly in the modern world, it's since people live so separately and distantly, you have to use your judgment on these things. I'll say ever so often, and it has nothing to do with Orthodox conservatives, not really relevant. People will sit in different places because the different mourners live so far apart. And the deceased lives far from where the mourners live. So that if you had a deceased, we just had a case like that in Arzarua. Some of you have gotten some information about two of our congregants who lost parents in the last 2 weeks. One case was in Florida, one case was in South Africa. Now, in both those cases, these are odd situations, and you just have to deal with them. It's the reality of the world in which we live.
Accepted written response about the person who's lived, let's say, in an assisted age home, and so there's no more
domestic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting problem. There are generally the surviving children sit in their own home.
So what if they were still a sibling?
If there still were a sibling, the children would take precedence in all likelihood. Mm-hmm. Children would take precedence there, and the sibling would frequently sit with them with the children.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it usually works itself out. But I have heard also of some circumstances, and I don't think that they're common, where people sit in a home where a person was a resident. Because you also have these cases today. I mean, you have old age, you have the Hebrew home for the aged, where people come there for years. And it can be their home. And it is their home. You have a home up in Riverdale where it's an assisted living kind of facility. And you have all throughout Florida now, for example. Elderly people will live in assisted living, which is somewhere between a normal home. Some of the things are done communally and some of the things are done privately. So there are a lot of arrangements, and one has to use good judgment with these arrangements.
When my mother died, she lived in Queens. We sat in New York for part of the time, but we also sat in her house.
Mm-hmm.
She and I,
that's very common.
To try to make sure that both communities get a chance.
Right. I think that's really a very good idea, if it makes sense. Now I've had a number of cases here over the last while where elderly parents die, and they're exceedingly elderly. Let's say they're in their mid-90s or 100. or even beyond 100. And one of the things that's happening right now with that, that it's going to change, is that frequently people of that age don't have contemporaries. There's nobody left. So if that person lives, wherever that person lives, let's say, sometimes it doesn't make sense to sit there because there's nobody there. They just happen to be there in a rent-controlled apartment, or for a variety of other reasons they're there, but times have changed, but the peers are no longer there, the contemporaries are no longer there. I think that this is going to change because now you're seeing more people living into their mid-90s and even to 100, and they seem to be unusual. Now there's one person and there are no contemporaries. I suspect that what will happen over time, and there probably is a limit to this, but what's going to happen is that it will become more common, and that in fact you will have peers who will be of that same age. That would be my hunch. Okay?
If you sit Shiva in the parents' home,
right,
would you sleep over? I don't care what you mean. You sit Shiva in my parents' home, but they would stay overnight. Mm-hmm. And go back to your own home. Mm-hmm. So you're really going out.
The ideal is not to go out. The ideal is to sleep there.
To
actually sleep there. That depends on how practical it is. Sometimes it's practical, very frequently it's not practical. For a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's not practical because of your own family. Wife, children, so on. Sometimes it's not practical because people just don't want to be in that sort of intense environment. It gets a little bit complicated. It's complicated.
Where you want to sleep? You're going to sleep in the bed you slept in when you were a little kid.
Yeah, I mean,
I think the same could be a little bold.
Same could be a little bold. There are a variety of possibilities. As I say, you have
so
to use.
You should not go out.
You should not go out unless you have to go out. Again, you have to use judgment. I think that it makes sense to use judgment with these things.
So, going through that, some of these practicalities, makes me think that this could be, you should not go out, could be to reiterate that you have your services in the home and not go to shul, and that even though there isn't much place to sleep or whatever, you should be staying in that home. So, it really could be that there are questions, and it's not so obvious as Rabbi, whoever, said, is that this is obvious that during the week of Shiva people are coming to you. I don't think it is so
mm-hmm.
obvious that there are issues that would make someone leave the home.
Some people sometimes tell me also, because they've been in this situation, and they all stay in the same home, and they don't go home, that is sometimes a wonderful experience, that siblings sometimes see each other and have a sort of intense relationship for that period of time, which they simply haven't had since they were children, since they left the house. Sometimes that can be comforting. I can't say, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but sometimes that can be comforting.
Sounds good to me.
I suspect that it sounds good to you, and it probably doesn't sound good to some other people, but there are a variety of possibilities.
Especially since people live so far away from each other these days.
Yeah, I think that the reality that's being reflected here also is the geographic closeness.
Sounds like a new
people
reality show, right?
Bill Moyers had a program once on Shiva, and he was so impressed with the customs of Shiva that when his own parent died, he observed Shiva. And he had a program about it. I don't know if anyone else.
Who was that?
Bill
Moyers.
Is he Jewish?
There is a lot of logic to this. Okay, let's go on. Tanu Rabbanan, another bright guy. Kol Shloshim Yom L'Nisuim. All, a mourner is subject all 30 days to the marriage restrictions. That is to say, he may not marry for 30 days. Interesting. Okay? There, normally in our tradition, there is a tremendous positive emphasis on marriage. And we'll see a variety of different issues when there's a conflict between mourning and marriage. But here, we're talking about a mourner. For 30 days, he can't get married. And this is now speaking about a male mourner. Speaking about a male mourner.
Even if the wedding has been preset?
Wait a minute, hold on. You just read the first line of the Baraita.
Oh.
I wouldn't get carried away yet. Okay? Kol Shloshim Yom Nisui. So, for 30 days, there are restrictions in getting married. Meta Ishto. Now, here's a particular person who dies. A man's wife dies. Asur lisa isha acheret ad sheyavru alav shlosha regalim. A man may not get married. He may not marry another wife until three festivals have passed. Until three festivals have passed. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, over on the next page in the English. Rabbi Yehuda says, Regel Rishon V'Sheni Asur, the first festival, the second festival, it is prohibited, that is to say, you can't get married. Shlishi Mutar, by the time of the third one, though, it is permissible to get married. The im ein lo banim mutar lisa yalter. And if he has no children, he may get married immediately. Mishum bito pirya urivya. I'm just reading it through, so some of the obvious issues that I'm sure are occurring to you even as I read it are of course obvious issues and are discussed by all of the commentators. But I just want to read it through first so we can see the context. It's moving along step by step here. So we started with just generally speaking the prohibition of a marriage for 30 days. Specifically now when a man's wife dies, there is a longer prohibition. If the man has no children, he can get married immediately. Mishum bitul pirya v'rivya. Because of the nullification of the mitzvah of be fruitful and multiply. It is a mitzvah for a man to be fruitful and multiply, to have children. I'm not sure exactly what that means to have children, whether it means a male child and a female child. It's not clear. There's arguments about that among the commentators, but whatever it is, if he has no children, he surely hasn't fulfilled the mitzvah of Piria Verivia. And he can get married, says here, immediately. Hinicha lo banim katanim, if the wife who died left him with young children, mutar v'sali alter, he may get married immediately, mitne parnasatan, in order to take care of them, in order to have somebody to take care of the young children. You think it's funny?
Laura smiles. Take care of children.
Well, especially since the assumption is he's working.
Yeah, but what about how is it? How you live?
What?
How you live?
That's a very good point.
You don't need
that. Okay, but all of these, as I said to you a moment ago, as I'm reading through this, I'm sure that issues are occurring to you, all of which, including this, there's a whole literature on exactly what you just said, on the issue of hired help, because that is one of the ways that you could solve this problem. And then the commentators will say, well, this must be for somebody who cannot afford to have hired help. And the question is, are there any other people who may take the place of hired help? For example,
relatives.
Grandparents. A whole variety of other possibilities here. Okay. Ma says Shemeta Ishto Shel Yosef HaKohen. Once it happened that the wife of Yosef HaKohen died. He amar la achota bevet ha-kfarat. And he said to her sister in the cemetery, you can see what's coming here. Alright, he had his eyes out for his wife's sister. They go to the cemetery, and he says to the wife's sister in the cemetery, all right, the body isn't even cold. He says to his sister-in-law, all right, L'chi ufarnasi ebenei achotech. Go and take care of the children of your sister.
Not my kids.
Meaning, of course, we'll get married. And that is, it's not that he is simply looking for somebody to be live and help with the sister of the wife, the deceased wife, but this is his way of saying, let's get married. Okay? Afal pichin lo ba'alea elaliz man meruga. And even so, he did not have any sexual relations with her until a long time had passed. Now, of course, there's a lot unsaid in this story. But let's go back to the beginning of the book. Let's start with
one.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's right. So, my Lizman Muraba, what is the meaning of a long time? Amara Papa, Yechar Shloshim Yom, means 30 days. So the assumption is then that he married her before 30 days. He married her before 30 days. But he didn't have sex with her until after 30 days. Okay? Now, let's go back to the beginning. And let's take this and now let's think about what this could mean. Generally speaking, we see that if a person is a mourner, and remember you're a mourner for a variety of different people, father, mother, sister, brother, spouse, child, all of those deaths can make you a mourner. So during that period of time, ideally speaking, the assumption is here that we do not have an arrangement for marriage already, that we have not hired the orchestra, we have not hired the rabbi, we have not hired the hall, we have not made any expenditures nor any commitments. Okay? That's the assumption here. And in particular it says nisuin. Nisuim. Realize that the term Nisuim is a technical term when it is used in the Talmud. There are in the Talmud two stages in marriage. Erusin and Nisuim. Erusin and Nisuim in a Jewish wedding ceremony today. Erusin and Nisuim take place in the same ceremony. So when you are under the chuppah, the first part of what is done under the chuppah, you have, number one, the blessings that are said, Birkat Erusin, that praises God. You say, Borei Pera Gafen, over a cup of wine, and then you say, Blessed are you, O Lord our God, who has sanctified us by his commandments and commanded us about the fact that we are not allowed to take someone unless they are betrothed to us. Okay? That's erusin. Then you have a ring ceremony. That is the erusin. Commonly called in English betrothal. And it does bear some relation to our modern sense of betrothal. But it is not marriage. In fact, during the time of the Talmud, a year would separate Erusin and Nisuin. A year. An entire year would separate the two. after the erusine would take place, she would go back to her family, he would go back to his family, and in fact they would not live as husband and wife.
So it's like an engagement.
So it's sort of like an engagement. However, if they wanted to break it up, they would need a get.
Oh,
they would need a get.
The erusine
you need a get. So it was serious stuff. But in fact, it wasn't the completion of the process because they couldn't live together as husband and wife.
This is similar to this custom of the bands being posted.
Bands being posted? What are you referring to?
You hear it in English literature a lot.
They literally post in their churches the names of the bride and groom, and they sit there in Catholic churches in Italy for four weeks. So it's a public announcement that this man and this woman want to be betrothed. And in essence, if anyone has a problem or whatever, can let it be known. So it's posted in the band.
I see. Very interesting.
Probably got it.
I have no idea. Could be.
And it's even in the more churches in the Milan. It's not exclusive to what you might think of as this nostalgically small environment.
Interesting.
Ban.
B-A-N. Double N?
Yes.
Yes? Very interesting. I never heard of this before.
Yeah,
fascinating. Very interesting.
Three successive weeks.
Yeah, you got four chapters during the band in the Jane Austen novel.
Whoa.
Very interesting.
There's nothing that dictates it should be 1 year. It was just a custom.
That was the custom. That was the custom. That was the way it was carried out, was the a year would take place. If you see this as to some extent, very interesting to, in modern life, see the nature of betrothal. Betrothal meaning engagements. In my, what used to be short and is now getting to be a longer lifespan, I've seen engagements of every possible kind that you can imagine. I've seen it. When I was 18, 19, 20, 21, let's say, engagements were major events. I remember when we were seminary students, there was a young lady who was at Barnard student. She used to be in the seminary dining room. So she came into the dining room one day and she says, hello. She says, hello. What's going on here? She says, hello. I'm totally unaware, what's happening here. And then my fellow students say to me, oh, she's engaged. Of course, it had passed me by. I was not connected to those things. But what she was doing was showing off her ring. Then I lived through the times when everybody who was cool would never do anything like that. There used to be, before that time, big engagement parties. Then when the engagement would break up, it would be a disaster, and they'd have to give back presents, and it was very embarrassing. And that moved to nothing. Then that moved even to marriages with nothing. That if you were really cool, you'd never get married. Now,
going back.
Now, weddings, people spend fortunes on weddings. Not that the people haven't been living together. So what's the big deal with a marriage? They have enormous weddings. The kinds of weddings that would have been embarrassing even in my early years. So these things undergo changes. They're undergoing changes all the time.
Immensely elaborately planned engagements, because I could give you a recital of at least 35 engagements from you name a country, and I can give you one from my students who have given me, these are 28, 30 year old men, full blown reports of what they planned.
They're engaged.
From a hot air balloon in Spain, and I can go, no digression.
And this is not the wedding.
Excuse me, this is engagement.
Okay.
So around the world, we give you one of these
so
engagements.
In Jewish literature, if any of you would like to see sort of a more recent instance of this. If any of you know the literature of Chaim Grada, are you familiar with his novels? He has, for example, a two-volume novel translated into English in two volumes, The Yeshiva, which is one of the great books of Yiddish literature, which is available in English. Chaim Grada's The Yeshiva. It is the best insight into Eastern European Jewish life that I know. It's a masterpiece. It's like a Dickens novel. It's probably the greatest Jewish novel until Agnon, maybe even after Agnon. But Grada was one of the great Yiddish writers of our time previously. So Grada writes of somebody who was engaged, meaning engaged, who broke off the engagement. And it was a disaster because it was considered to be very unseemly to break off an engagement. And it was like a divorce, like you were running out on the woman. And it's another instance of the way these things change over time. What happened in Jewish life was that at the end of the 11th century and the 12th century, the marriage ceremony changed. Our marriage ceremony changed to the ceremony we have today. So the ceremony we have today is not the ceremony that was in the Talmud. It's the ceremony that dates from the beginning of the 12th century. And the reason why it changed was as a result of the Crusades. The Crusades created such a disaster in Jewish life. Realize the Crusaders, the first Crusades started in 1096. They made it to the Holy Land by 1099. Right? 1096, their mitzvah until they got there was to kill as many Jews as they could. So, for the first time now, in Christian Europe, the idea of slaughtering Jews became an issue in Jewish communal life. Since Roman times, you really didn't have that as a major issue that would affect halacha. Roman times, you did. Martyrdom was an issue in Roman times. Prohibition against Jewish practice was an issue. But it's not until the Crusades that that becomes an issue. And as a result of that, the rabbis changed the laws of marriage. In order to bring the ceremony together, the erusin and the nisuin were put into one ceremony because they felt that marriage was so significant that you couldn't afford to wait a year.
Okay.
You didn't know where you're going to be a year from now. It was too much dislocation, social dislocation, as a result of the Crusades. So it was as a result of the Crusades that we have our modern ceremony. And it has stayed the same since then.
When does the nisuin start?
In the modern ceremony, the reason in the middle of the ceremony you read the ketubah is to separate erusin from nisuin. It's after the ketubah that you have nisuin.
So Sheva Brachot
is it nisuin?
Is
no, nisuin. That's nisuin.
It's after the ketubah.
It's after the ketubah. That's what the ketubah.
So which are the brachot before the?
Is Birkat Erusin? It's the Borek Ragafen,
yeah.
The first Borek Ragafen, because then you have a second Borek Ragafen, which is the first of the Sheva Brachot,
yeah.
And then the blessing Birkat Erusin, which is about the laws of marriage, that we are only allowed to be with people to whom we are married, that we cannot have relations with other people, and so on. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all the Erusin. So what we have now is a combined ceremony.
And the ring is part of erusin?
Ring is part of erusin. Ring is erusin.
Was there back to what happened at the Crusades, there must have been myriad other forms of sort of gathering together or the changes in the way that customs were accommodated during the Crusades in order for that same purpose of sort of making more cohesive or centralizing or...
I'll tell you the other one. Are
there very few?
There aren't a lot.
Oh.
Marriage was an issue.
Yeah.
Marriage. The other one that began with the Crusades was Kaddish.
Yeah.
Kaddish began with the Crusades. We never had Mourner's Kaddish. Mourner's Kaddish has no place in the Talmud. No place in the Talmud. It's the Crusades that bring Mourner's Kaddish into the picture, as well as Yizkor. Yizkor that we're used to having on the festival. Yizkor, no precedent for Yizkor in the classical period. It starts with the Crusades.
And was that the last time that sort of defensive sort of measure was taken to change the customs to protect sort of to protect things from being?
It's the last time until this afternoon. I mean that seriously.
Yeah.
What has happened in the last 75 years is that tons of customs have been created in order to sort of do the same thing. We're not always conscious of them, but there are many, many things going on in Jewish life today. I see it in Israel all the time. It's done in this country in order to be able to deal with the problems in the product of emancipation, of Jews integrating into communities. So that there are other such things that happen all the time.
Because really, that sounds like a way of making it easier to get married.
Yeah, sure.
And even the Kaddish, it seems like it's a way of easier. It's an easier way of mourning.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you didn't do this, but you said these lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure whether it's easier or not, because
I
have to say
that it's like that it's utilitarian.
Kaddish would allow you to make your mourning portable if you were dislocated.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in a community where everybody knows you and you know everybody.
Keep in mind also the history of this, though. The history of Kaddish was the Kaddish was said first for communities before it was said for individuals.
I think it was because it was such a catastrophic event. And that there was no way of emoting what happened, that they had to find some vehicle to express their feelings.
Not unlikely.
And they searched and they came up with the Kaddish.
Not unlikely. I don't want to get into Kaddish here. We're sort of in. We're in this because of Nisuin.
The Avraham Rachman that we say comes from the same period.
I believe the Avraham Rachman is later than that.
Later,
yes. I don't know when that begins, but I think it's even later. I wanted actually to do a study of that to see if I could figure out when it actually began. And as far as I know, no one has done that. It's interested me. If there are phases in it, like Yitzhar Bitzhar Chayim, which don't appear in the classical literature as far as I can see. And I wonder where those concepts come from. I think they're Kabbalistic. So that means that they would be after the Zohar, I think. So I would place it sometime in the 14th century, which is considerably after what I'm talking about. That was the beginning of the 12th century. So that's interesting to me, but I don't know. I don't have the answer to the question.
The 14th century also had the Black Death and pretty much
right.
And that probably was of a similar.
Keep in mind, I was thinking about this last week when I was in Jerusalem, just at occasion to study a little bit of some local history, and also to explain some of this history, even to some of our congregants who were there. We had the good fortune of several Azara people who visited us last week. If you think of what was going on, the Crusades were a terrible time. Even in the Jewish community of Jerusalem, where Jews have lived fairly continuously, when the Christians got to Jerusalem, they banned Jews from living in Jerusalem. And it wasn't until Saladin, who, you know, the Arabs today are looking to as the great savior, Saladin, who kicked out the Christians, invited the Jews to come back.
Why?
Because there was no reason to kick them out. The Jews are, you know, Jews are helpful in any society. Jews have certain economic values in society. when you finally get to the Ottoman period, because there are ups and downs, also because Christians came back, but there are ups and downs with the Arabs. It varied with different Arab leaders. Finally, when the Turks come in the 16th century, that's when the Ottoman Empire takes over, and the walls of the city of Jerusalem that we see today were built by Suleiman the Magnificent. Suleiman built that in 1595, I think. He finished the job in 1595. But relatively speaking, rather recent. Suleiman, when he built those walls, invited the Jews to come back. He really wanted Jews to be in the city because he felt that the Jews were very helpful to the city while he was ruling it. And he, of course, was not an Arab. So it's, you know, these things are going on today. The Turks are not Arabs. They're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. And there is a tension between the Arabs and the Turks.
Yeah. At that time of the Crusades, and around the time of the Crusades, and until the First World War, a large part of the Jewish people lived under Muslim rule.
Sure.
So did they adopt these customs that we established in Europe?
Who?
The marriage customs, etc.
Well, those were done. It's interesting. Yes, those were adopted over the years in different stages. And marriage customs tend to be rather conservative. And they were nearly universally adopted. I cannot say universally, because the universal adoption of marriage customs didn't occur till the 1950s. And as a matter of fact, even today there are exceptions to our marriage rules. They occurred in the 1950s with the immigration of the Yemenites.
Yes.
Because the Yemenites came to Israel with numerous wives, and they did not know of or abide by the law of Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century, which prohibited polygamy. So that the Yemenites were polygamists when they came to the state of Israel, and the state of Israel accepted that reality, but said that once you come here, you can no longer marry multiple wives.
And the British did that.
Okay. Well, I don't know about the British. I know as far as Jewish law goes, that's what Jewish law said, as far as the state of Israel goes. And yet, I don't know the situation. I think but I'm not sure. The Ethiopians have brought with them also some...
But not to the degree of the Yemenites.
No, not to the degree of the Yemenites. The Yemenites were really a separate, but a very, very firm community, the Yemenites. And they study the law according to Maimonides. Maimonides was not affected by any of these Ashkenazi pronouncements. He didn't, he lived in a different world. So, but other than that, other than the Yemenites, these marriage customs did become universal in Jewish communal life.
Thank you.
Okay?
This is the first expulsion of the Jews from England was 1090.
1290, I think 1290. So that's later. Okay? Now, all this now, I'm looking at the bright in detail. Right? All this is coming out of the detailed reading of the Baraita. Kol Shloshim Yom L'Nisuin. So what this means in context is they already have had Erusin. Right? So that the force of this is not that you simply don't initiate things entirely. Since it says Nisuin, they already have had the Erusin. So that there's some time in this year period of time now. And what we are learning, therefore, is that for 30 days, you cannot have the Nisuin. So the Nisuin, then, the Erusin is continued on for a longer period of time. What is not said is the Erusin issue. And therefore, the Talmud doesn't comment on that, and therefore there's a whole literature of the rabbis post-Talmudically trying to say, well, since this says Nisuin, what do we learn about Erusin? And about that, all the possibilities are discussed among the rabbis. Tremendous variety of custom there as far as Erusin. For us, it makes no difference, because Erusin and Nisuin are together. But the rabbinic writings until the end of the 11th century realized that they left the Erusin out of this. And so it was an issue in rabbinic law until the end of the 11th century.
this husband who loses a wife who hasn't had children, all of that gets totally condemned. Because there's not, I mean, that's just going to show you how absolute immediate they want that to be. They, you know, they withheld that whole year of heresy, and that person can get married almost immediately.
Correct.
There
could be.
Motherless.
There could be.
Or
exactly.
They hadn't had
correct.
They didn't want them not to.
Exactly. Exactly. That is correct. That is correct.
Even more collided.
What about the woman?
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. Let's take the next one. Meta ishto. Now, meta ishto, when a man's wife dies. Okay? Now, to begin with, this could appear strange because we've seen stringent customs in one area, death of father and mother. Right? The father and mother have consistently been the deceased that have triggered an unusual level of response. And we've noticed that, and, you know, sometimes we said, well, it's unusual in the modern context. We would have assumed that the most serious case would be the death of children, and we've explained why that wasn't the case in the time of the Talmud. But nonetheless, it's been clear that consistently the Talmud has dealt with father and mother's death as triggering the strongest reactions. You don't see that here. You don't see that. Here, it's the wife. It's the death of the wife that that triggers the reaction. Okay? Meta isho asur lisa isha acheret ad sheyavru alav shlosha regalim. And the scripture here is that a man cannot get married until three festivals have passed. Until three festivals have passed. Now, from the text, we wouldn't know. Because I can tell you three festivals, for example. Let's say a woman dies September 1st.
Yes.
Most cases, what happens? What's the first festival that comes after that? Is Rosh Hashanah. What comes after that? Okay, cool. What comes after that? So by October, you're married. So that's the problem here. The problem is, to begin with, problem number one is, what do we mean by a regel?
Regel is the Yerushalayim.
Okay, so the regel is, as the commentators decide, the regel is, here I'm reading to you the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says, Asur lisa acheret ad sheyavru alea shalosh regalim. The Rosh Hashanah v'yom ha-kippurim einam chashuvim k'regalim le'inyan zeh.
They're not important.
Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for this matter are not considered to be regalim.
Okay.
Certain matters of halacha they may be considered to be regalim, but in this matter they are not considered to be regalim. So in fact, if the wife were to die then September 1st, you have to wait till Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot, and only after that could you get married again. Okay. Now, the question is, why? Why this unusual emphasis and the delay of a marriage here? Because you saw, coming up, we're going to be aware of certain situations which are exceptional and require a quicker marriage, but that only emphasizes how unusual it is here that we require a person to wait for three regalim. And why the regalim? Because I might have said a year. I might have said a year. Okay. So, well, there are three, but it depends upon the timing of things. Right?
It's 9 months. For some people, it's a
Seven months.
Some people
will
be almost
12 months. Correct. Correct. Let's say she dies the day after Shavuot.
Yeah.
She dies the day after Shavuot. That means you have to wait a year. Right? If she dies the day before Sukkot, that's the shortest of the possibilities. think.
Yeah, then you have Shavuot.
We have to get till Shavuot.
So is that in order to stop you from getting married for the wrong reasons?
What are those reasons?
Well, I don't know. If it's built around the regalim, then maybe it's task someone to be cooking and cleaning for the regal. I don't know. Should you not get married just to have things be
Well, in theory, there are a lot of possibilities here. Let's take a look at the Tosafot. Let's look at the Tosafot first. I want you to see what the Tosafot now are writing in the 12th century. These are Frenchmen of the 12th century who are writing. Tosafot now is, if you look on the Hebrew side of the page, it's Kaf Gimel Amud Aleph, 23a. It's actually the second Tosafot. Tosafot, remember, are on the outside of the page. They're out here. This is the Tosafot. The inside is Rashi. Normally it would be Rashi, but it's not actually Rashi. Tosafot are on the outside of the Talmudic text. The second of the Tosafot here says, Ad Shiyavru Shlosha Regalim, until three festivals have passed. Ad shiyeh shlosha regalim b'lo simcha, until three festivals have passed b'lo simcha, without joy. So interesting psychology here. The assumption is that in married life the festivals are times of tremendous joy, and you need to just wean yourself away from the joy that was with the wife that you had, and allow that time to pass before starting over again. So it's Ad shiyeh shlosha regalim b'lo simcha. V'lo yishkach ahavat ishto. Right? Because otherwise he won't forget the love of his wife. Right? He loved his wife, and the festivals themselves will recall the love of the wife. If you marry somebody else right away, then comes the festival, and who will you be thinking about? Well, the old one. You'll be thinking of correct. You'll be thinking of the old wife when the new wife is there.
But then you still have two wives, so.
No, not then. Not in the time of the Tosafot. Okay.
Even in the
time of the rabbis. In the whole Talmud, one or two people have multiple wives. Nobody in the Talmud had multiple wives. It was just not done. In the Bible, yes, but not in the Talmud. Talmud people did not practice polygamy, with one or two exceptions. Okay, so it's not practiced.
Is that the general public as well?
What?
Not having multiple wives.
Yeah, people didn't have, and we have no evidence that there was any practice of polygamy in Talmudic times. Absolutely no literary evidence, no archaeological evidence, no evidence whatsoever. I mean, even archaeologically, you see the number of bedrooms you have in a house. We have archaeological work that's been done in Israel over the last year. No evidence whatsoever that there was any practice of polygamy. So polygamy, in effect, went out of style at the biblical times. Biblical times, we know that there was. I mean, we have plenty of evidence in the Bible, but not in the time of the Talmud. So it's not that. It's not that there was another wife at home.
Right.
There was one wife. The assumption was that there was one wife. And the difficulty is bringing in the second wife with thoughts of the first wife. So there's a cooling off period here. And the cooling off period is around the regel. Because it's especially at times like that, which are times of family joy, that one is most conscious of the loss. Well, that's okay, but don't bring it on the new wife. Just let that pass, let it take its normal course, and it will cool off, and then you bring the new wife into the picture. Okay? Let's go. I want to go on with this a little further. And here he brings, I'm sort of interpreting it, but he'll bring this in a more pointed way. Inami, or another possibility. Kedei sheyehe isha acheret. Kedei sheyisa isha acheret velo yehe zachur mina rishona. So this is really almost the same thing. I've really explained it this way, so that when he marries the next wife, he won't be thinking about the former wife, right? And he'll be able then to concentrate on the next, on the new wife. Shelo yehe bet deot, the mita achat.
Shtei deot.
Right? Bet deot. Shtei deot. So that there will not be literally two minds in one bed. That is to say, he'll be sleeping with the new wife, and he'll be thinking about the old wife.
I love it.
When you're going to sleep with your wife, you have to think about this wife. Your mind can't be on anybody else. Your mind can't be on anybody else. Therefore, you need the cooling off period, as it were, and you go through the year.
Now
okay?
You
tell
us.
Okay.
You might think that the better rule would be if it was a fixed period that also included the three festivals, because what you have now is something that can just vary between, I don't know, something like 7 months.
7 months?
Right,
three years. 3 years. It seems to me that you want to have some kind of maybe fixed year, which would also include all those festivals.
You have this in this context, you have it in a few other contexts, where the festivals are the fixture, and they create the time frame. And I think it probably reflects just the importance of these things in life. You know, for us, frankly, the festivals are relatively unimportant. I mean, I can say that again, having been in Israel last week, in a Jewish country where there's a Jewish calendar, where in effect, they're very important. I see that in this country, let's say. People have Christmas experiences, you know, feelings of family at Christmas time, and they don't have any other time in the year. In Jewish life, you have that around the festivals. So you're right, but I would interpret it, you know, that for whatever reason, the cooling off period was probably 6 months. But what they, in effect, are doing is saying 6 months or longer if there'll be three festivals. Okay? Because the minimal time is 6 months. So, in effect, you've got a minimal time which is probably enough time. But it's really not enough time if you haven't had enough festivals. Because every time the festival comes, you feel those feelings again of what it was like with the last wife. So that's the way I interpret it.
The time frame that they're talking here is the same concept used in the concept of a divorce, between the time you get divorced and the time you remarry?
No. Because it's different. Because the relationship is different. It's not completely different, but it's different enough so that you don't have the same loss. But you have some, the laws are not simple. I mean, but they're somewhat like it, but it's not the same.
What are the exceptions of the married sister of the deceased? Sister of the deceased.
Mm-hmm. Yibum.
They have a special exception.
Right, that's Yibum. Yibum. Yibum is, according to the Bible, if a man dies.
What?
And leaves his wife without child, right? In that case, his brother is required to marry his wife. Okay? That's called Yibum in the Bible.
He already has a wife.
Correct. Yes. because in that context, polygamy is permissible. Again, by the time of the Talmuds, the rabbis have changed the law because polygamy was no longer really practiced, so that there is an alternative, which is called chalitza. Chalitza is the removal of the shoe.
Release.
And it's release from the law of Yibum. By the time of the rabbinic law, chalitza is practiced regularly because polygamy is no longer allowed, or it's no longer practiced. It's not outlawed, so I can't really say it's allowed. It's not allowed, but chalitza has been practiced. So that's a different case.
What about the reverse? Marrying the sister of the vine. The vine dies.
Well, that could be. Well, that's the case that we have right here in the Talmud. Talmud brings a case like that where he sees the sister in the cemetery. he proposes to her right near the grave, on the gravesite. Okay? So that's possible. It's possible. It's not required, but it's certainly possible.
I'm surprised, but I guess I shouldn't be, that I would have thought it was in order to have a certain period of respect for the wife. I mean, that would seem to be the obvious answer of waiting for three festivals. But it seems as though the next wife's sensibilities
right.
are more important than
correct.
The previous wife's
well,
emotions.
Let's take a look at the English here. Just look at number 15 on 23A2. It is not that mourning one's wife is more stringent than mourning for other relatives, because the citation from the Ritva. Rather, if one were to marry before three festivals have passed, it would appear that he is not pained by the death of the first wife. So this is along the lines of what you're saying. And that's in the Rashi manuscript. That's the Rashi that's in the very small print on the side of the page. So that sensitivity is also there in the Rashi. Okay? Alternatively, the rabbis wanted the widower to remain three festivals without joy, so that he not forget the love of his first wife. That's again along the lines of what you were saying. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Listen to the social historian, and I don't know whether this is true about Jews because they never really study them in terms of social history, but they always talk about romantic love and marriage being a very, very late post-Enlightenment kind of concept. And I don't know whether this reinforces that or that they really didn't take into account the way Jews, you know, regarded family life.
Interestingly enough, I think that love, as we understand it, particularly in the context of marriage, was a Jewish idea from antiquity. Exactly. When you see
Jacob.
The first one is Isaac, that he brings Rebekah to his mother's tent, and then the Torah says, Vayeehaveha, and he loved her. So that you have love is a major theme in the Bible. It's a major theme in the Bible. It's not what comes to be known in European literature as romantic love, so that's actually, I think, somewhat different. We have the study of chivalrous love, let's say, in medieval literature, that is not the same. I mean, it's not totally different, but it's also not totally the same. It's not the same. I think it's really different.
14 years working is pretty romantic.
Excuse me?
I think working for 14 years for someone is pretty romantic.
You better believe it. That's the Jacob story. The Jacob story, Jacob's love for Rachel, it's just incredible. I went last week to pay respects to Rachel. I went to Rachel's tomb. I went to Gerar Rachel.
Bethlehem?
I went to Bethlehem.
Terrible. After the invasion, I was there last week.
Sorry, I was there last week. Was it 3 days? 5 days?
To take some people out from there.
I tell you, I was just there. I went, it's been a while since I was there, so I had time to go and do that. It's a touching thing to do. So you think about these things, about his relation to Rachel, and the fact in last week's Parsha, I had been there on Thursday. Friday, Jacob says, when he tells the story, he says, Meta alai Rachel. Right?
A lie.
She died on me. Right? Rachel died on me. You know, the nerve of this woman who I love so much, she died on me. She died on me. In the Hebrew, at least for us English speakers, it resounds. You know, it doesn't sound really so good, but that seems to be what it says. So, you know, I thought about that, just being there. And I had wanted also to go to Hebron, but it was not doable for practical reasons. And that's the distance between Bethlehem and Hebron, because Hebron is where everybody else is buried. And Jacob is buried in Hebron. Except that Yosef is buried in the north, in Shechem. But the exception here is Rachel, and where she is buried. And it was just, it's very poignant. The political side of it, by the way, is terrible. I must say, I was just really, I just felt almost distraught. I went there it was an Israeli bus, an Eged bus, that goes to Kever Rachel, and you can pick it up. It leaves the central bus station in Jerusalem, stops along the way, and you take it, and you get it right. When you get close, there is a checkpoint, a machzon, and it goes around. Cars don't go the way this goes. A car, you can't drive a car to Kever Rachel. But what you see is the wall. The Israelis have built this tremendous fortification all around when you get close to Kever Rachel, because the Arabs are shooting into Kever Rachel. So they build this tremendous wall. You feel like you're going into a fort. I remember Kever Rachel. Yeah. And it was outdoors.
It
was completely open.
Yeah.
And what it has turned into is a fort.
So is the Marat HaMachpelah?
No, Marat HaMachpelah is not like that. Marat HaMachpelah is exactly the way it was 2,000 years ago. No different today. There's no fortification at Marat HaMachpelah at all. But Kever Rachel has been turned into a fort. I just found it to be a terrible. You know, you just see up close. You know, it's just very concrete, because it's all these huge concrete barriers. I'm talking 15, 20 feet high, several stories high, that just, you feel like you're in a no man's land. It's just awful. It's just awful. You know, it is what it is. I mean, I don't say this to you with any political... I can't draw any political conclusions from it whatsoever. I have no idea what to make of the whole thing. On the one hand, it just is awful. It's necessary. I mean, this barrier that the Israelis are creating between them and the Palestinians apparently has cut down the suicide bombings tremendously. So that's its justification. So it's justified, I guess, but it just looks horrible. It's just horrible.
With the emphasis on childbearing and all this, what other ramifications, if any of the three people are or were infertile? If there weren't going to be children anyway, or if there can't be children anyway, that affect?
Don't know that.
Well, I think that from the Talmud's perspective, they would not assume that knowledge. They would assume that you wouldn't know that. That even the barren woman can have a child.
And
the Talmud's assumption would be that that is not a permanent state. If we could assume that in modern times, I suppose it would be different. But generally, we assume that no such position is an absolute state. Wait, who hasn't had a chance?
I was just curious. I've always understood that the rebels were times of great mixing among the genders. So perhaps the three festivals were also an opportunity for this bereaved husband, as he moves from his bereavement, to also meet
Interesting.
And have the opportunity to meet over time a prospective new partner, unless the practice was that you tried to find someone from your own domain.
Well, I don't really know when we talk about the mixing, which is quite correct.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we think of it in terms of first marriages,
yes,
young men, young women. That's the way we usually think of it.
The
truth is, though, any time you bring a large number of people together,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of people meet. So,
correct.
It's an interesting thought. Interesting thought.
Well, I was hoping that you were going to keep going this little paragraph from your resume of a woman whose husband has died.
Yes, let's take a look at that before we conclude. A woman whose husband has died, however, may remarry even before three festivals have passed. Now, it's interesting that the law is different for men and for women. So the question is, why is it different?
She can support herself.
Yeah, I think that the clear reason has to do with support. That the assumption is that in that world, a woman didn't have a source of support. And therefore, in order to be able to make that possible, if it was possible for her to get married, then that's something that was considered to be a reasonable exception to what otherwise would be the rule. Yes?
The issue of the 6 months of the Frida Dream is not maybe to bring to, you know, if the parent died is a year, and if the child died is 30 days and very little done about it. So maybe to elevate the wife not to a parent degree of elevation, but someplace in between. Was it considered, was this the reason, or?
Well, that's, you saw the Ritva and Rashi do bring that as the reason, that it is to elevate the wife who has died to make sure that one treats her with a proper level of respect and affection.
Why didn't do a year? Why, you see, for a parent,
mm-hmm.
it's a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think probably the reason has to do just with sex. It's a very interesting thing in this tradition, that the assumption is that men should be married. And I think that that's also relevant here, that if men are not married, they will become philanderers in terms of their sexual behavior, and that it is centrally important to domesticate males, and therefore you don't let these periods of time just go on, because it creates situations which are not good. So I think you'll see that again and again.
In the case of the wife that dies and the husband being permitted to marry the sister,
okay,
right away. I think it avoids the sister because I've lived through a situation like that. There's a tremendous feeling of the sister, the living sister, to want to marry the husband and assume responsibility for her dead sister's children,
mm-hmm.
and there's also a tremendous psychological feeling or need to, okay, to keep the family together, okay, so that the husband doesn't marry out and take the children out.
Mm-hmm.
I know this very, very intimately because that was the case of my first wife. When her sister died, her brother-in-law asked her to marry her within 6 months,
mm-hmm.
okay, the small children in the house and things
mm-hmm.
like that. So I think while the discussion here is to the male, okay, for
mm-hmm.
all the reasons. All the other psychological implications and needs and everything else like that from the female side, you know, are also very, very real.
Absolutely. 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 Very interesting. And they're not the same necessarily, the male reaction.
Yeah, it's talking about, which I think
yeah. yeah, it's very interesting. And along those lines, too, here you see that even if, as in the story that's brought, they got married so soon, where he proposed to her on the cemetery, that still, it says that that he didn't have sex with her immediately.
Yeah.
So that's another dimension to the
right.
thing. There are these reasonable, rational, and emotional things,
right.
but there is a reticence with the sexual side, which probably also reflects the reality. other effects are there. Not that it shouldn't happen, but that it's simply delayed a reasonable amount of time. Not too long, but not too short. Okay?
I'm affected by what you said about the importance of the Galim in terms of emotional impact that it can have on a person. And I like the Tosfos that emphasizes the love between a husband and a wife.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that that's so stressed here.
Mm-hmm.
Makes an assumption that there was a deep love between
yeah.
a husband and a wife.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think if one was used to having sitting down together at a table, and you know how much work the wife has had to put into, it's like Shabbos also. You can't say you have to wait until all the Shabbos is passed. But a person would think, I have to get my wife, I have kids, and I have to do everything yet. He won't realize until the time comes how intense the feeling is.
That's right.
I don't know how that, but I'm sure that's
right.
the case. I've seen that. So you've got to give yourself a chance to see how will it affect you, because I'm sure you can't know how it's going to affect you
until it happens. Until you have to go through.
And then other people will suffer.
On that note, I think we can conclude. Very good. We'll pick it up again next week. How are you? Everything's good. Keep it
good. Okay, Rabbi. I'm now ready to ask you for a time to sit down.